you a preacher? I say. No, he says, I am not a preacher. I am a doctor who works not with bodies, but with minds. Diseases of the mind and brain and the nerves. I put my hands with the apple behind my back. I do not trust him at all. No, I say, I won't go back there, not to the asylum. Flesh and blood cannot stand it. Don't be afraid, he says. You aren't mad, really, are you, Grace? No, sir, I am not, I say. Then there is no reason for you to go back to the asylum, is there? They don't listen to reason there, sir, I say. Well, that is what I am here for, he says. I am here to listen to reason. But if I am to listen to you, you will have to talk to me. I see what he's after. He is a collector. He thinks all he has to do is give me an apple and then he can collect me. Perhaps he is from a newspaper, or else he is a traveling man making a tour. They come in and stare. And when they look at you, you feel as small as an ant, and they pick you up between finger and thumb and turn you around, and then they set you down and go away. You won't believe me, sir, I say. Anyway, it's all been decided. The trial is long over and done with, and what I say will not change anything. You should ask the lawyers and the judges and the newspaper men. They seem to know my story better than I do myself. In any case, I can't remember. I can remember other things, but I have lost that part of my memory entirely. They must have told you that. I would like to help you, Grace, he says. That is how they get in through the door. Help is what they offer. But gratitude is what they want. They roll around in it like cats in catnip. He wishes to go home and say to himself, I stuck in my thumb and pulled out the plum. What a good boy am I. But I will not be anybody's plum. I say nothing. If you will try to talk, he continues, I will try to listen. My interest is purely scientific. It is not only the murders that should concern us. He's using a kind voice, kind on the surface, but with other desires hidden beneath it. Perhaps I will tell you lies, I say. He doesn't say, Grace, what a wicked suggestion, you have a sinful imagination. He says, perhaps you will. Perhaps you will tell lies without meaning to, and perhaps you will also tell them deliberately. Perhaps you are a liar. I look at him. There are those who have said I am one, I say. We will just have to take that chance, he says. I look down at the floor. Will they take me back to the asylum? I say. Or will they put me in solitary confinement with nothing to eat but bread? He says, I give you my word that as long as you continue to talk with me and do not lose control of yourself and become violent, you shall remain as you were. I have the governor's promise. I look at him. I look away. I look at him again. I hold the apple in my two hands. He waits. Finally, I lift the apple up and press it to my forehead. Four. Young Man's Fancy. Among these raving maniacs, I recognize the singular face of Grace Marks, no longer sad and despairing, but lighted up with the fire of insanity, and glowing with a hideous and fiend-like merriment. On perceiving that strangers were observing her, she fled shrieking away like a phantom into one of the side rooms. It appears that even in the wildest bursts of her terrible malady, she is continually haunted by a memory of the past, unhappy girl. When will the long horror of her punishment and remorse be over? When will she sit at the feet of Jesus, clothed with the unsullied garments of his righteousness, the stain of blood washed from her hand, and her soul redeemed and pardoned and in her right mind? Let us hope that all her previous guilt may be attributed to the incipient workings of this frightful malady. Susanna Moody, Life in the Clearings, 1853. It is of the greatest regret that we do not have the knowledge whereby we might cure these unfortunate afflicted. A surgeon can cut open an abdomen and display the spleen. Muscles can be cut out and shown to young students. The human psyche cannot be dissected, nor the brain's workings put out on the table to display. When a child, I have played games with a blindfold obscuring my vision. Now I am like that child, blindfolded, groping my way, not knowing where I am going or if I am in the proper direction. Someday, someone will remove that blindfold. Dr. Joseph Workman, Medical Superintendent, Provincial Lunatic Asylum, Toronto. Letter to Henry, a young and troubled inquirer, 1866. One need not be a chamber to be haunted. One need not be a house. The brain has corridors surpassing material place. Ourself behind ourself concealed should startle most. Assassin hid in our apartment be horrors least. Emily Dickinson, circa 1863. 2. Dr. Simon Jordan, M.D., Laburnum House, Loomisville, Massachusetts, the United States of America. From Dr. Joseph Workman, Medical Superintendent, the Provincial Lunatic Asylum, Toronto, Canada West. April 15, 1859. Dear Dr. Jordan, I beg to acknowledge receipt of your letter of 2nd inst., and to thank you for the letter of introduction from my esteemed colleague, Dr. Binswanger of Switzerland, the establishment of whose new clinic I have followed with great interest. Permit me to say that as an acquaintance of Dr. Binswanger, you would be most welcome to inspect the institution of which I am the superintendent at any time. I would be most pleased to show you over the premises myself and to explain our methods to you. As you intend to establish an institution of your own, I should emphasize that sanitation and good drainage are of the first importance, as it is of no use to attempt to minister to a mind diseased whilst the body is afflicted by infections. This side of things is too often neglected. At the time of my advent here, we had many cholera outbreaks, perforating dysenteries, intractable diarrheas, and the whole deadly typhoid family which were plaguing the asylum. In the course of my investigations as to their source, I discovered a large and exceedingly noxious cesspool underlying every part of the cellars, in some places the consistency of a strong infusion of black tea, and in others like viscid soft soap, which was undrained due to the failure of the builders to connect the drains to the main sewer, in addition to which the water supply for both drinking and washing was drawn through an intake pipe from the lake in a stagnant bay close by the pipe through which the main sewer discharged its putrid flow. It is no wonder that the inmates often complained that their drinking water tasted of a substance which few among them had ever experienced any great longing to consume. The inmates here are pretty evenly divided as to sex. As to symptoms, there is a great variety. Religious fanaticism I find to be fully as prolific an exciting cause of insanity as intemperance, but I am inclined to believe that neither religion nor intemperance will induce insanity in a truly sound mind. I think there is always a predisposing cause which renders the individual liable to the malady when exposed to any disturbing agency, whether mental or physical. However, for information regarding the chief object of your inquiry, I regret that you must seek elsewhere. The female prisoner, Grace Marks, whose crime was murder, was returned to the penitentiary at Kingston in August of 1853 after a stay of 15 months. As I myself was appointed only some 3 weeks prior to her departure, I had little chance of making a thorough study of her case. I have therefore referred your letter to Dr. Samuel Bannerling, who attended her under my predecessor. As to the degree of insanity by which she was primarily affected, I am unable to speak. It was my impression that for a considerable time she had been sufficiently sane to warrant her removal from the asylum. I strongly recommended that in her discipline, gentle treatment should be adopted, and I believe she presently spends a part of each day as a servant in the governor's family. She had, towards the latter end of her stay, conducted herself with much propriety, whilst by her industry and general kindness towards the patients, she was found a profitable and useful inmate of the house. She suffers occasionally under nervous excitement and a painful overaction of the heart. One of the chief problems facing the superintendent of a publicly funded institution such as this is the tendency on the part of prison authorities to refer to us many troublesome criminals, among them atrocious murderers, burglars, and thieves who do not belong among the innocent and uncontaminated insane, simply to have them out of the prison. It is impossible that a building constructed with a proper reference to the comfort and the recovery of the insane can be a place of confinement for criminal lunatics, and certainly much less so for criminal impostors. And I am strongly inclined to suspect that the latter class are more numerous than may generally be supposed. Besides the evil consequences inevitably resulting to the patients from the commingling of innocent with criminal lunatics, there is reason to apprehend a deteriorating influence on the tempers and habits of the keepers and officers of the asylum, unfitting them for the humane and proper treatment of the former. But as you propose to establish a private institution, you will, I trust, incur fewer difficulties of this nature, and will suffer less from the irritating political interference that frequently prevents their rectification. And in this, as in general matters, I wish you every success in your endeavors. Enterprises such as yours are unfortunately much required at present, both in our own country and in yours, as, due to the increased anxieties of modern life and the consequent stresses upon the nerves, the rate of construction can scarcely keep pace with the numbers of applicants, and I beg to proffer any small assistance which it may lie within my power to bestow. Yours very truly, Joseph Workman, M.D. From Mrs. William P. Jordan, Laburnum House, Loomisville, Massachusetts, the United States of America. To Dr. Simon Jordan, care of Major C.D. Humphrey, Lower Union Street, Kingston, Canada West. April 29th, 1859. My dearest son, your long-awaited note containing your present address and the instructions for the rheumatism salve arrived today. It was a joy to see your dear handwriting again, even so little of it. And it is good of you to take an interest in your poor mother's failing constitution. I take this opportunity to write you a few lines, while enclosing the letter which arrived here for you the day after your departure. Your recent visit to us was all too brief. When may we expect to see you among your family and friends once more? So much traveling cannot be salutary either for your peace of mind or for your health. I long for the day when you choose to settle down among us and to establish yourself properly in a manner fitting to you. I could not help but observe that the enclosed letter is from the Lunatic Asylum in Toronto. I suppose you intend to visit it, although surely you must have seen every such establishment in the world by now and cannot possibly benefit from seeing another. Your description of those in France and England, and even of the one in Switzerland, which is so much cleaner, filled me with horror. We must all pray to have our sanity preserved. But I have grave doubts concerning your future prospects, should your proposed course of action be pursued. You must forgive me for saying, dear son, that I have never been able to understand the interest you take in such things. No one in the family has ever concerned himself with lunatics before, although your grandfather was a Quaker clergyman. It is commendable to wish to relieve human suffering, but surely the insane, like idiots and cripples, owe their state to Almighty Providence, and one should not attempt to reverse decisions which are certainly just, though inscrutable, to us. In addition, I cannot believe a private asylum could possibly be made to pay, as the relatives of lunatics are notoriously neglectful once the afflicted person has been put away and wish to hear or see nothing more of them. And this neglect extends to the settlement of their bills, and then there is the cost of food and fuel and of the persons who must be put in charge of them. There's so many considerations to attend to, and surely the daily consorting with the insane will be far from conducive to a tranquil existence. You must think, too, of your future wife and children, who ought not be placed in such close proximity to a pack of dangerous madmen. I know it is not my place to determine your path in life, but I strongly urge that a manufactory would be far preferable, and although the textile mills are not what they were due to the mismanagement of the politicians who abuse the public trust unmercifully and become worse with every passing year, yet there are many other opportunities at present, and some men have done very well at them, as you hear of new fortunes being made every day, and I am sure you have as much energy and sagacity as they. There is talk of a new sewing machine for use in the home, which would do exceedingly well if it might be cheaply produced, for every woman would wish to own such an item, which would save many hours of monotonous toil and unceasing drudgery, and would also be of great assistance to the poor seamstresses. Could you not invest the small inheritance remaining to you after the sale of your poor father's business in some such admirable but dependable venture? I am certain that a sewing machine would relieve as much human suffering as 100 lunatic asylums, and possibly a good deal more. Of course, you have always been an idealist and filled with optimistic dreams, but reality must at some time obtrude, and you are now turned 30. I say these things not from any wish to meddle or interfere, but out of a mother's anxious care for the future of her only and beloved son. I do so hope to see you well established before I die. It would have been your dear father's wish as well. You know I live only for your welfare. My health took a turn for the worse after your departure. Your presence has always an improving effect upon my spirits. I was coughing so much yesterday that my faithful Maureen could scarcely get me up the stairs. She is almost as old and feeble as I am, and we must have looked like two old witches hobbling up a hill. Despite the concoctions I am dosed with several times a day, brewed by my good Samantha in the kitchen, which taste as vile as all medicines ought to, and which she swears cured her own mother, I continue much the same. Although I was well enough today to receive, as usual, in the parlor, I had several visitors who had heard of my indisposition, among them Mrs. Henry Cartwright, who has a good heart, although not always a very polished manner, as is often the case with those whose fortunes have been of recent acquisition, but that will come in time. Accompanying her was her daughter Faith, whom you will recall as an awkward girl of 13, but who is now grown up and recently returned from Boston, where she was staying with her aunt, to broaden her education. She has turned out a charming young woman, everything one might wish for, and displaying a courtesy and gentle kindness many would admire, and which is worth so much more than flamboyant good looks. They brought with them a basket of delicacies, I am thoroughly spoiled by dear Mrs. Cartwright, for which I expressed much gratitude, although I could barely taste anything, as I have no appetite at present. It is a sad thing to be an invalid, and I pray every night that you may be spared, and will take care not to overtire yourself with too much study and nervous strain, and with staying up all night by lamplight, ruining your eyes and puzzling your brain to pieces, and to wear wool next to the skin until the warm weather is fully here. I predict that he will end as an inhabitant of the private asylum I still dream of establishing, although I must curb my propensity to view each new acquaintance as a future paying inmate, It is remarkable how frequently military men, when retired on half pay, go to the bad. It is as if, having become habituated to strong excitements and violent emotions, they must duplicate them in civilian life. However, my arrangements were made not with the Major, who would doubtless not have been able to recall having made them, but with his long-suffering wife. I take my meals, with the exception of the breakfasts, which have been thus far even more deplorable than the breakfasts we shared as medical students in London, at a squalid inn located in the vicinity, where every meal is a burnt offering, and nothing is thought the worse for the addition of a little dirt and grime and a seasoning of insects. That I remain here despite these travesties of the culinary art, I trust you will recognize as a measure of my true devotion to the cause of science. As for society, I must report that there are pretty girls here, as elsewhere, albeit dressed in the Paris fashions of 3 years ago, which is to say the New York fashions of two. Despite the reforming tendencies of the country's present government, the town abounds both in disgruntled Tories and also in petty provincial snobberies. And I anticipate that your bearish and carelessly dressed, and what is more to the purpose, your Yankee Democrat friend, will be viewed with some suspicion by its more partisan inhabitants. Nonetheless, the governor, at the urging of Reverend Verringer, I suppose, has gone out of his way to be accommodating, and has arranged to have Grace Marks placed at my disposal for several hours every afternoon. She appears to act in the household as a sort of unpaid servant, although whether this service is viewed by her as a favor or a penance I have yet to ascertain. Nor will it be an easy task, as the gentle Grace, having been hardened in the fire now for some 15 years, will be a very hard nut to crack. Inquiries such as mine are ineffective, unless the trust of the subject may be gained, but judging from my knowledge of penal institutions, I suspect Grace has had scant reason to trust anyone at all for a very long period of time. I have had only one opportunity thus far of viewing the object of my investigations, and so it is too soon to convey my impressions. Let me say only that I am hopeful, and as you have so kindly expressed a desire to have news of my progress, I will take pains to keep you informed of it. And until then, I remain, my dear Edward, your old friend and erstwhile companion, Simon. Simon sits at his writing table, gnawing the end of his pen and looking out the window at the gray and choppy waters of Lake Ontario. Across the bay is Wolf Island, named after the famous poetic general, he supposes. It's a view he does not admire. It is so relentlessly horizontal. But visual monotony can sometimes be conducive to thought. A gust of rain patters against the window pane. Low, tattered clouds are scudding above the lake. The lake itself heaves and surges. Waves are pulled in against the shore, recoil, are pulled in again, and the willow trees below him toss themselves like heads of long green hair and bend and thrash. Something pale blows past. It looks like a woman's white scarf or veil, but then he sees it is only a gull fighting the wind. The mindless turmoil of nature, he thinks. Tennyson's Teeth and Claws. He feels none of the jaunty hopefulness he has just expressed. Instead, he is uneasy and more than a little dispirited. His reason for being here seems precarious, but it's his best chance at the moment. When he entered upon his medical studies, it was out of a young man's perversity. His father was a wealthy mill owner then, and fully expected Simon to take over the business in time, and Simon himself expected the same thing. First, however, he would rebel a little. He would slip the traces, travel, study, test himself in the world, and also in the world of science and medicine, which had always appealed to him. Then he would return home with a hobby horse to ride and the comfortable assurance that he need not ride it for money. Most of the best scientists, he knows, have private incomes, which allows them the possibility of disinterested research. He hadn't expected the collapse of his father, and also of his father's textile mills. Which came first, he's never been sure. Instead of an amusing row down a quiet stream, he's been overtaken by a catastrophe at sea, and has been left clinging to a broken spar. In other words, he has been thrown back on his own resources, which was what, During his adolescent arguments with his father, he claimed to most desire. The mills were sold, and the imposing house of his childhood, with its large staff of domestics, the chambermaids, the kitchen maids, the parlor maids, that ever-changing chorus of smiling girls or women with names like Alice and Effie, who cosseted and also dominated his childhood and youth, and whom he thinks of as having somehow been sold along with the house. They smelled like strawberries and salt. They had long, rippling hair when it was down, or one of them did. It was Effie, perhaps. As for his inheritance, it's smaller than his mother thinks, and much of the income from it goes to her. She sees herself as living in reduced circumstances, which is true, considering what they have been reduced from. She believes she is making sacrifices for Simon, and he doesn't want to disillusion her. His father was self-made, but his mother was constructed by others, and such edifices are notoriously fragile. Thus, the private asylum is far beyond his reach at present. In order to raise the money for it, he would have to be able to offer something novel, some new discovery or cure, in a field that is already crowded and also very contentious. Perhaps, when he has established his name, he will be able to sell shares in it, but without losing control. He must be free, absolutely free, to follow his own methods, once he has decided exactly what they are to be. He will write a prospectus. Large and cheerful rooms, proper ventilation and drainage, and extensive grounds, with a river flowing through them, as the sound of water is soothing to the nerves. He'll draw the line at machinery and fads, however. No electrical devices, nothing with magnets. It's true that the American public is unduly impressed by such notions. They favor cures that can be had by pulling a lever or pressing a button. But Simon has no belief in their efficacy. Despite the temptation, he must refuse to compromise his integrity. It's all a pipe dream at present. But he has to have a project of some sort to wave in front of his mother. She needs to believe that he's working towards some goal or other, however much she may disapprove of it. Of course, he could always marry money, as she herself did. She traded her family name and connections for a heap of coin fresh from the mint, and she is more than willing to arrange something of the sort for him. The horse trading that's becoming increasingly common between impoverished European aristocrats and upstart American millionaires is not unknown, on a much smaller scale, in Loomisville, Massachusetts. He thinks of the prominent front teeth and duck-like neck of Miss Faith Cartwright, and shivers. He consults his watch. His breakfast is late again. He takes it in his rooms, where it arrives every morning, carried in on a wooden tray by Dora, his landlady's maid of all work. She sets the tray with a thump and a rattle on the small table at the far end of the sitting room, where, once she has gone, he seats himself to devour it, or whatever parts of it he guesses to be edible. He has adopted the habit of writing before breakfast at the other and larger table, so he may be seen bent over his work and will not have to look at her. Dora is stout and pudding-faced, with a small, down-turned mouth like that of a disappointed baby. Her large black eyebrows meet over her nose, giving her a permanent scowl that expresses a sense of disapproving outrage. It's obvious that she detests being a maid of all work. He wonders if there's anything else she might prefer. He has tried imagining her as a prostitute. He often plays this private mental game with various women he encounters, but he can't picture any man actually paying for her services. It would be like paying to be run over by a wagon, and would be, like that experience, a distinct threat to the health. Dora is a hefty creature, and could snap a man's spine in two with her thighs, which Simon envisions as grayish, like boiled sausages, and stubbled like a singed turkey, and enormous, each one as large as a piglet. Dora returns his lack of esteem. She appears to feel that he has rented these rooms with the sole object of causing trouble for her. She fricassees his handkerchiefs and overstarches his shirts and loses the buttons from them, which she no doubt pulls off routinely. He's even suspected her of burning his toast and overcooking his egg on purpose. After plumping down his tray, she bellows, "Here's your food!" as if calling a hog. Then she stumps out, closing the door behind her, just one note short of a slam. Simon has been spoiled by European servants who are born knowing their places. He has not yet reaccustomed himself to the resentful demonstrations of equality so frequently practiced on this side of the ocean, except in the South, of course. But he does not go there. There are better lodgings than these to be had in Kingston, but he doesn't wish to pay for them. These are suitable enough for the short time he intends to stay. Also, there are no other lodgers, and he values his privacy and the quiet in which to think. The house is a stone one, and chilly and damp, but by temperament, it must be the old New Englander in him. Simon feels a certain contempt for material self-indulgence, and as a medical student, he became habituated to a monkish austerity and to working long hours under difficult conditions. He turns again to his desk. "Dearest Mother," he begins, "thank you for your long and informative letter. I am well and making considerable headway here in my study of nervous and cerebral diseases among the criminal element, which, if a key to them may be found, would go a long way towards alleviating..." He can't go on. He feels too fraudulent. But he has to write something, or she will assume he is drowned, or died suddenly of consumption, or been waylaid by thieves. The weather is always a good subject. But he can't write about the weather on an empty stomach. From the drawer of his desk, he takes out a small pamphlet that dates from the time of the murders, and which was sent to him by Reverend Verringer. It contains the confessions of Grace Marks and James McDermott, as well as an abridged version of the trial. At the front is an engraved portrait of Grace, which could easily pass for the heroine of a sentimental novel. She'd been just 16 at the time, but the woman pictured looks a good 5 years older. Her shoulders are swathed in a tippet. The brim of a bonnet encircles her head like a dark aureole. The nose is straight, the mouth dainty, the expression conventionally soulful. The vapid pensiveness of a Magdalene, with the large eyes gazing at nothing. Beside this is a matching engraving of James McDermott, shown in the overblown collar of those days, with his hair in a forward-swept arrangement reminiscent of Napoleon's, and meant to suggest tempestuousness. He is scowling in a brooding, Byronic way. The artist must have admired him. Beneath the double portrait is written, in copperplate, "Grace Marks, alias Mary Whitney. James McDermott, as they appeared at the courthouse, accused of murdering Mr. Thomas Kinnear and Nancy Montgomery." The whole thing bears a disturbing resemblance to a wedding invitation. Or it would, without the pictures. Preparing himself for his first interview with Grace, Simon had disregarded this portrait entirely. She must be quite different by now, he thought, more disheveled, less self-contained, more like a suppliant, quite possibly insane. He was conducted to her temporary cell by a keeper who'd locked him in with her, after warning him that she was stronger than she looked and could give a man a devilish bite, and advising him to call for help if she became violent. As soon as he saw her, he knew this wouldn't happen. The morning light fell slantingly in through the small window high up on the wall, illuminating the corner where she stood. It was an image almost medieval in its plain lines, its angular clarity. A nun in a cloister, a maiden in a towered dungeon awaiting the next day's burning at the stake, or else the last-minute champion come to rescue her. The cornered woman, the penitential dress falling straight down, concealing feet that were surely bare, the straw mattress on the floor, the timorous hunch of the shoulders, the arms hugged close to the thin body, the long wisps of auburn hair escaping from what appeared at first glance to be a chaplet of white flowers. And especially the eyes, enormous in the pale face and dilated with fear or with mute pleading. All was as it should be. He'd seen many hysterics at the Salpêtrière in Paris who'd look very much like this. He approached her with a calm and smiling face, presenting an image of goodwill, which was a true image after all, because goodwill was what he felt. It was important to convince such patients that you, at least, did not believe them to be mad, since they never believed it themselves. But then Grace stepped forward, out of the light, and the woman he'd seen the instant before was suddenly no longer there. Instead, there was a different woman, straighter, taller, more self-possessed, wearing the conventional dress of the penitentiary, with a striped blue and white skirt beneath which were 2 feet, not naked at all, but enclosed in ordinary shoes. There was even less escaped hair than he'd thought. Most of it was tucked up under a white cap. Her eyes were unusually large, it was true, but they were far from insane. Instead, they were frankly assessing him. It was as if she were contemplating the subject of some unexplained experiment, as if it were he, and not she, who was under scrutiny. Remembering the scene, Simon winces. "I was indulging myself," he thinks. "Imagination and fancy. I must stick to observation. I must proceed with caution. A valid experiment must have verifiable results. I must resist melodrama and an overheated brain." There's a scuffling outside the door, then a thumping. It must be his breakfast. He turns his back and can feel his neck retracting down into his collar like a turtle's into its shell. "Come in," he calls, and the door flies open. "Here's your food," bawls Dora. The tray bumps down. She marches out, and the door bangs shut behind her. Simon has a fleeting and unbidden image of her, strung up by the ankles in a butcher shop window, with cloves stuck into her and a rind on her like a sugared ham. The association of ideas is truly remarkable, he thinks, once one begins to observe its operations in one's own mind. Dora, pig, ham, for instance. In order to get from the first term to the third, the second term is essential, though from the first to the second and from the second to the third is no great leap. He must make a note of it. Middle term essential. Perhaps a maniac is simply one for whom these associative tricks of the brain cross the line that separates the literal from the merely fanciful, as may happen under the influence of fevers and of somnambulistic trances and of certain drugs. But what is the mechanism? For there must be one. Is the clue to be found in the nerves or in the brain itself? To produce insanity, what must first be damaged, and how? His breakfast must be getting cold if Dora has not deliberately chilled it in advance. He levers himself out of his chair, disentangling his long legs, stretches himself and yawns, and goes over to the other table, the one with the tray on it. Yesterday, his egg was like India rubber. He'd mentioned it to his landlady, the wan Mrs. Humphrey, and she must have admonished Dora because today the egg is so undercooked as to be scarcely jellied, with a bluish tinge to it, like an eyeball. Curse the woman, he thinks. Sullen, brutish, vengeful. A mind that exists at sub-rational level, yet cunning, slippery, and evasive. There's no way to corner her. She's a greased pig. A piece of toast cracks like slate between his teeth. "Dearest mother," he composes in his head. "The weather here is very good. The snow is almost gone. Spring is in the air. The sun is warming the lake, and already the vigorous green tips of..." Of what? He has never known much about flowers. I am sitting in the sewing room at the head of the stairs in the governor's wife's house, in the usual chair, at the usual table, with the sewing things in the basket as usual, except for the scissors. They insist on removing those from within my reach, so if I want to cut a thread or trim a seam, I have to ask Dr. Jordan, who takes them out of his vest pocket and returns them to it when I've finished. He says he does not feel any such rigmarole as necessary, as he considers me to be entirely harmless and in control of myself. He appears to be a trusting man, although sometimes I just bite the thread off with my teeth. Dr. Jordan has told them that what he wishes is an atmosphere of relaxation and calm. It is more conducive to his purposes, whatever they may be. And so he recommended that I was to be kept in the same daily routine as much as possible. I continue to sleep in my allotted cell, and I wear the same clothing and eat the same breakfast, in silence, If you can call it silence, 40 women, most of them in here for nothing worse than stealing, who sit chewing their bread with their mouths open and slurping their tea in order to make a noise of some sort, even if not speech, with an edifying Bible passage read out loud. You can have your own thoughts then. But if you laugh, you must pretend you are coughing or choking. Choking is better. If choking, they hit you on the back, but if coughing, they have the doctor. A hunk of bread, a mug of weak tea, meat at dinner, but not much of it. Because overfeeding on rich foods stimulates the criminal organs of the brain. Or so say the doctors, and the guards and keepers then repeat it to us. In that case, why are their own criminal organs not more stimulated, as they eat meat and chickens and bacon and eggs and cheese and as much as they can get? That is why they are so fat. It is my opinion that they sometimes take what is intended for us, which would not surprise me in the least, as it is dog-eat-dog around here, and they are bigger dogs. After breakfast, I am brought over to the governor's mansion as usual, by two of the keepers who are men, and not above making a joke amongst themselves when out of hearing of the higher authorities. "Well, Grace," says the one, "I see you have a new sweetheart. A doctor, no less. Has he gone down on his knees yet? Or have you lifted your own up for him? He'd better keep a sharp eye out, or you'll have him flat on his back." "Yes," says the other, "flat on his back in the cellar with his boots off and a bullet through his heart." Then they laugh. They consider this very comical. I try to think what Mary Whitney would say. And sometimes I can say it. "If you really thought that of me, you should hold your dirty tongues," I said to them, "or one night I'll have them out of your mouths root and all. I won't need a knife. I'll just take hold with my teeth and pull, and not only that, I'll thank you to keep your filthy screw's hands to yourself." "Now can't you take a bit of fun? I'd welcome it if I was you," says the one. "We're the only men that's ever going to lay a hand on you for the rest of your life. You're shut up in there like a nun. Come on now, confess, you're longing for a tumble. You were ready enough with that runty little James McDermott before they stretched his crooked neck for him, the murdering bastard." "And that's the way, Grace," says the other one. "Up on your high horse, just like a spotless maiden, no legs on you at all. You're as pure as an angel, you are, in a pig's ear, as if you've never seen the inside of a man's bedroom in the tavern in Lewiston. We heard about that. Putting on your stays and stockings you was when you were nabbed. But I'm glad to see there's still a touch of the old hellfire left. They ain't worked it out of you yet." "I like a bit of spirit in a woman," says the one. "Or a whole bottleful," says the other. "Gin leads to sin, God bless it. There's nothing like a little fuel to make the fire burn." "Drunker the better," says the one. "And out stone cold is the best. Then you don't have to listen to them. There's nothing worse than a squalling whore." "Were you noisy, Grace?" says the other. "Did you squeal and moan? Did you wiggle underneath that swarthy little rat, looking at me to see what I'll say? Sometimes I say, I won't have that kind of talk," which makes them laugh heartily, but as a rule I say nothing. And that is the way we pass the time, out to the prison gateway. "Who goes there?" "Oh, it's only you. Good day, Grace. Got your two young men with you, have you? Tied to your apron strings." A wink and a nod. And then along the street, each holding fast to an arm. They don't need to do that, but they like it. They lean in on me, closer and closer, until I'm squeezed between them, through the mud, over the puddles, around the piles of horse dung, past the trees in bloom in the fenced yards, their tassels, their flowers like pale yellow-green caterpillars dangling, and the dogs barking, and the carriages and wagons passing, sploshing through water on the road, and the people staring because it's obvious where we have come from. They can tell by my clothing. Until we go up the long drive with herbaceous borders and around to the servants' entrance. "And here she is, all safe and sound. She tried to escape, didn't she, Grace? Tried to give us the slip. She's a cunning one for all her big blue eyes. Well, better luck next time, my girl. You should have hitched up your petticoats higher and shown a clean pair of heels and some ankle while you was at it," says the one. "Oh, no, higher still," says the other. "Hoisted them up around your neck, and you should have gone off like a ship in full sail, arse to the wind. We would have been smitten by your dazzling charms, knocked on the head like lambs at slaughter, Struck by lightning we would have been. You would have got clean away. They grin at each other and laugh. They've been showing off. They have been talking to each other all this time, and not to me. They are a low class of person. I do not have the run of the house as before. The governor's wife is still frightened of me. She's afraid I will have another fit, and she doesn't want any of her best teacups broken. You would think she never heard anyone scream before. So I do not dust these days, or carry in the tea tray, or empty the chamber pots, or make up the beds. Instead, I'm set to work in the back kitchen, cleaning the pots and pans in the scullery. Or else I work in the laundry. I do not mind that so much, as I always like doing the laundry. It is hard work and roughens the hands, but I like the clean smell afterwards. I help the regular laundress, old Clary, who is part colored and used to be a slave once, before they did away with it here. She is not afraid of me. She doesn't mind me or care what I may have done, even if I killed a gentleman. She only nods as if to say, "So that's one less of them." She says I'm a steady worker and pull my share and don't waste the soap, and I know the treatment of fine linen. I have the way of it, and also how to get out the stains, even from the blonde lace, which is not easy to come by, and a good clear starcher, too, and can be trusted not to burn the things in ironing, and that is enough for her. At noon we go into the kitchen, and cook gives us what is left over from the larder. At the very least some bread and cheese and meat broth, but usually something more, as Clary is a favorite of hers, and is known to have a temper if crossed, and the governor's wife swears by her, especially for laces and ruffles, and says she is a treasure and has no equal, and would be annoyed to lose her. So she is not stinted, and because I am with her, neither am I. It's better food than I'd get on the inside of the walls. Yesterday we had the chicken carcass and all that was on it. There we sat at the table like foxes in the henhouse gnawing the bones. They made such a fuss about the scissors upstairs, but the whole kitchen is bristling with knives and skewers all over like a porcupine. I could slip one into my apron pocket as easy as rolling off a log, but of course they never even think about that. Out of sight, out of mind is their motto, and below stairs is like below ground as far as they are concerned. And little do they know that the servants carry away more out the back door with a spoon than the master can bring in the front door with a shovel. The trick of it is to do it little by little. One small knife would never be missed, and the best place to hide it would be in my hair, under my cap, well pinned in, as it would be a nasty surprise if it fell out at the wrong time. We cut up the chicken carcass with one of the knives, and Clary ate the two little oysters off the bottom, near the stomach, you might say. She likes to get those if they are left, and she, being the senior, has first choice. We did not say much to each other, but we grinned, because eating this chicken was so good. I ate the fat off the back and the skin. I sucked the rib bones, then I licked my fingers like a cat. And after we were done, Clary had a quick smoke of her pipe on the step, and then it was back to work. Miss Lydia and Miss Marianne between them dirty a lot of washing, although much of it is not what I would call dirty at all. I believe they try things on in the morning and change their minds, and then take the things off and drop them carelessly on the floor and step on them, and then into the wash they must go. After the hours have gone by and the sun on the clock upstairs has moved around to the middle of the afternoon, Dr. Jordan arrives at the front door. I listen for the knocking and the ringing and the clatter of the maid's footsteps, and then I'm taken up the back stairs, my hands washed as white as snow with the soap from the laundry, and my fingers all wrinkled from the hot water like someone newly drowned, but red and rough all the same. And then it is time to sew. Dr. Jordan sits down in the chair across from me. He has a notebook which he puts on the table. He always brings something with him. The first day it was a dried flower of some sort. Blue, it was. The second day, a winter pear. The third, an onion. You never know what he will bring, although he inclines to fruits and vegetables. And at the beginning of each talk, he asks me what I think about this thing he has brought. And I say something about it, just to keep him happy. And he writes it down. The door must be kept open at all times, because there cannot be even a suspicion, no impropriety, behind closed doors. How comical if they only knew what goes on every day during my walk here. Miss Lydia and Miss Marianne pass by on the stairs and peep in. They won't have a look at the doctor. They are as curious as birds. Oh, I believe I left my thimble in here. Good day, Grace. I hope you're feeling yourself again. Do excuse us, please, Dr. Jordan. We do not mean to disturb you. They give him ravishing smiles. The word has gone round that he is unmarried and with money of his own, although I do not think either of them would settle for a Yankee doctor if they could get something better. However, they like to practice their charms and attractions on him. But after he has smiled at them with his uneven smile, he frowns. He doesn't pay much attention to them. They are only silly young girls and not the reason he is here. I am the reason. So he does not wish our talk to be interrupted. On the first 2 days there was not much talk to interrupt. I kept my head down. I did not look at him. I worked away at my quilt blocks for the quilt I'm making for the governor's wife. There are only 5 blocks left to be finished. I watched my needle go in and out, although I believe I could sew in my sleep. I've been doing it since I was 4 years old. Small stitches, as if made by mice. You need to start very young to be able to do that. Otherwise, you can never get the hang of it. The main colors are a double pink print, with a branch and flower in the lighter pink, and an indigo with white doves and grapes. Or else I looked over the top of Dr. Jordan's head at the wall behind him. There's a framed picture there, flowers in a vase, fruits in a bowl, in cross-stitch, done by the governor's wife, clumsily, too, as the apples and peaches look square and hard, as if they're carved out of wood. Not one of her best efforts, which must be why she's hung it in here and not in a spare bedchamber. I could do better myself with my eyes closed. It was difficult to begin talking. I had not talked very much for the past 15 years, not really talking, the way I once talked with Mary Whitney and Jeremiah the peddler, and with Jamie Walsh, too, before he became so treacherous towards me, and in a way I had forgotten how. I told Dr. Jordan that I did not know what he wanted me to say. He said it wasn't what he wanted me to say, but what I wanted to say myself that was of interest to him. I said I had no wants of that kind, as it was not my place to want to say anything. "Now, Grace," he said, "you must do better than that. We made a bargain." "Yes, sir," I said, "but I cannot think of anything." "Then let us discuss the weather," he said. "You must have some observations to make on it, since that is the way everyone else begins." I smiled at that, but I was just as shy. I'm not used to having my opinions asked, even about the weather, and especially by a man with a notebook. The only men of that kind I ever encountered were Mr. Kenneth Mackenzie, Esquire, the lawyer, and I was afraid of him, and those in the courtroom at the trial and in the jail, and they were from the newspapers and made up lies about me. Since I could not talk at first, Dr. Jordan talked himself. He told me about how they were building railroads everywhere now, and how they laid down the tracks, and how the engines worked, and the boiler and the steam. This had the effect of setting me more at my ease, and I said I would like to ride in a railway train like that, and he said that perhaps some day I would. I said I did not think so, being sentenced to be here for life, but then you can never tell what time we'll have in store for you. Then he told me about the town where he lives, which is called Loomisville, in the United States of America, and he said it was a mill town, although not as prosperous as before the cheap cloth from India came in. He said his father once owned a mill, and the girls who worked in it came from the country and were kept very tidy and lived in boarding houses provided with respectable and sober landladies, and no drink allowed, and sometimes a parlor piano, and only 12 hours of work per day, and Sunday mornings off for church. And by the moist and reminiscing look in his eye, I would not be surprised to learn that he once had a sweetheart among them. Then he said these girls were taught to read, and had their own magazine, which they published, with literary offerings. And I said, what did he mean by literary offerings? And he said they wrote stories and poems, which they put into it. And I said, under their own names? He said, yes, which I said was bold of them, and didn't it scare away the young men, as who would want a wife like that, writing things down for everyone to see, and made up things at that? I would never be so brazen. And he smiled, and said it did not appear to trouble the young men, as the girls saved up their wages for their dowries, and a dowry was always acceptable. And I said that at least after they got married they would be too busy to make up any more stories, because of all the children. Then I was sad, as I remembered that I would never be married now, or have any babies of my own. Though there can be too much of a good thing, you could say, and I would not like to have 9 or 10 and then die of it, as happens to many. But still, it is a regret. When you are sad, it is best to change the subject. I asked if he had a mother living, and he says yes, although her health was not good, and I said that he was fortunate to have a mother living, as mine was not. And then I changed the subject again and said I was very fond of horses, and he told me about his horse, Bess, that he had as a boy. And after a time, I don't know how it was, but little by little, I found I could talk to him more easily and think up things to say. And that is how we go on. He asks a question, and I say an answer, and he writes it down. In the courtroom, every word that came out of my mouth was as if burnt into the paper they were writing it on, and once I said a thing, I knew I could never get the words back. Only they were the wrong words, because whatever I said would be twisted around, even if it was the plain truth in the first place. And it was the same with Dr. Bannerling at the asylum. But now I feel as if everything I say is right. As long as I say something, anything at all, Dr. Jordan smiles and writes it down and tells me I am doing well. While he writes, I feel as if he is drawing me, or not drawing me, drawing on my skin, not with the pencil he is using, but with an old-fashioned goose pen, and not with the quill end, but with the feather end, as if hundreds of butterflies have settled all over my face and are softly opening and closing their wings. But underneath there is another feeling, a feeling of being wide-eyed, awake, and watchful. It's like being wakened suddenly in the middle of the night by a hand over your face, and you sit up with your heart going fast, and no one is there. And underneath that is another feeling still, a feeling like being torn open, not like a body of flesh. It is not painful as such, but like a peach, and not even torn open, but too ripe, and splitting open of its own accord. And inside the peach, there's a stone. From Dr. Samuel Bannerling, M.D., The Maples, Front Street, Toronto, Canada West, to Dr. Simon Jordan, M.D., care of Mrs. William P. Jordan, Laburnum House, Loomisville, Massachusetts, the United States of America. Redirected, care of Major C.D. Humphrey, Lower Union Street, Kingston, Canada West. April 20th, 1859. Dear Dr. Jordan, I am in receipt of your request to Dr. Workman of April 2nd concerning the convict Grace Marks, and of a note from him asking that I supply you with any further information at my disposal. I must inform you at once that Dr. Workman and I have not always seen eye to eye. In my estimation, and I was at the asylum for more years than he has yet been there, his policies of leniency have led him to undertake a fool's errand, namely the transforming of sows' ears into silk purses. Most who suffer from the more severe nervous and cerebral disorders cannot be cured, but merely controlled, for which purposes physical restraint and correction, a restricted diet, and cupping and bleeding to reduce excessive animal spirits have in the past proven efficacious enough, Although Dr. Workman claims to have obtained positive results in several cases previously considered hopeless, these supposed cures will no doubt in time prove to have been superficial and temporary. The taint of insanity is in the blood and cannot be removed with a little soft soap and flannel. Dr. Workman had the opportunity of examining Grace Marks for a few weeks only, whereas I had her under my care for over a year, and therefore his opinions on the subject of her character cannot be worth a great deal. He was, however, perspicacious enough to discover one pertinent fact, namely that, as a lunatic, Grace Marks was a sham, a view